and he will adore his children while doing bugger all to actually help look after them. And she will have perfect hair, but get this kind of pinched face. I narrowed my mouth. Through never saying what she actually means, and start an insane Pilates habit, or maybe buy a dog or a horse, and develop a crush on her riding instructor. And he will take up jogging when he hits 40, and maybe buy a Harley Davidson, which she will despise. And every day he will go to work and look at all the young men in his office, and listen in bars to who they pulled at the weekend, or where they went on a jolly, and feel like somehow, and he will never be quite sure how, he got suckered. I turned. Will was staring at me. Sorry, I said after a moment. I don't really know where that came from. I'm starting to feel just the tiniest bit sorry for Running Man. Oh, it's not him, I said. It's working at a cafe for years. You see and hear everything. Patterns in people's behaviour. You'd be amazed at what goes on. Is that why you've never got married? I blinked. I suppose so. I didn't want to say I had never actually been asked. It may sound as though we didn't do much, but in truth, the days with Will were subtly different, depending on his mood, and more importantly, how much pain he was in. Some days I would arrive and I could see from the set of his jaw that he didn't want to talk to me, or to anyone. And noting this, I would busy myself around the annex, trying to anticipate his needs so that I didn't have to bother him by asking. There were all sorts of things that caused him pain. There were the general aches that came with loss of muscle. There was so much less holding him up, despite Nathan's best attempts at physio. There was stomach pain from digestive problems, shoulder pain, pain from bladder infections, an inevitability apparently, despite everyone's best efforts. He had a stomach ulcer from taking too many painkillers early on in his recovery, when he apparently popped them like Tic Tacs. Occasionally there were pressure sores from being seated in the same position for too long. A couple of times Will was confined to bed, just to let them heal. But he hated being prone. He would lie there listening to the radio, his eyes glittering with barely suppressed rage. Will also got headaches, a side effect, I thought, of his anger and frustration. He had so much mental energy and nothing to take it out on. It had to build up somewhere. But the most debilitating was a burning sensation in his hands and feet. Relentless, pulsing, it would leave him unable to focus on anything else. I would prepare a bowl of cold water and soak them, or wrap cold flannels around them, hoping to ease his discomfort. A stringy muscle would flicker in his jaw, and occasionally he would just seem to disappear, as if the only way he could cope with the sensation was to absent himself from his own body. I had become surprisingly used to the physical requirements of Will's life. It seemed unfair that despite the fact he could not use them or feel them, his extremities should cause him so much discomfort. Despite all this, Will did not complain. This was why it had taken me weeks to notice he suffered at all. Now I could decipher the strained look around his eyes, the silences, the way he seemed to retreat inside his own skin. He would ask simply, "Could you get the cold water, Louisa?" Or, "I think it might be time for some painkillers." Sometimes he was in so much pain that his face actually leached colour, turning to pale putty. Those were the worst days. But on other days, we tolerated each other quite well. He didn't seem mortally offended when I talked to him, as he had at the start. Today appeared to be a pain-free day. When Mrs. Trainer came out to tell us that the cleaners would be another 20 minutes, I made us both another drink and we took a slow stroll around the garden, Will sticking to the path and me watching my satin pumps darken in the damp grass.
Interesting choice of footwear, Will said.
They were emerald green. I had found them in a charity shop. Patrick said they made me look like a leprechaun drag queen.
You know, you don't dress like someone from round here. I quite look forward to seeing what insane combination you're going to turn up in next.
So how should someone from round here dress? He steered a little to the left to avoid a bit of branch on the path.
Fleece. Or if you're my mother's set, something from Jaeger or Whistles.
He looked at me.
So where did you pick up your exotic tastes? Where else have you lived?
I haven't.
What, you've only ever lived here? Where have you worked?
Only here. I turned and looked at him, crossing my arms over my chest defensively. So, what's so weird about that?
It's such a small town. So limiting. And it's all about the castle.
We paused on the path and stared at it, rising up in the distance on its weird dome-like hill, as perfect as if it had been drawn by a child.
I always think this is the kind of place that people come back to, when they've got tired of everything else, or when they don't have enough imagination to go anywhere else.
Thanks.
There's nothing wrong with it, per se, but Christ, it's not exactly dynamic, is it? Not exactly full of ideas or interesting people or opportunities. Round here, they think it's subversive if the tourist shop starts selling placemats with a different view of the miniature railway.
I couldn't help but laugh. There had been an article in the local newspaper the previous week on exactly that topic.
You're 26 years old, Clark. You should be out there, claiming the world as your own, getting in trouble in bars, showing off your strange wardrobe to dodgy men.
I'm happy here, I said.
Well, you shouldn't be.
You like telling people what they should be doing, don't you?
Only when I know I'm right, he said. Can you adjust my drink? I can't quite reach it.
I twisted his straw round so that he could reach it more easily and waited while he took a drink. The faint cold had turned the tips of his ears pink. He grimaced.
Jesus, for a girl who made tea for a living, you make a terrible cup.
You're just used to lesbian tea, I said. All that Lapsang Souchong herbal stuff.
Lesbian tea?
He almost choked.
Well, it's better than this stair varnish. Christ, you could stand a spoon up in that.
So even my tea is wrong? I sat down on the bench in front of him. So how is it okay for you to offer an opinion on every single thing I say or do, and yet nobody else gets to say anything at all?
Go on then, Louisa Clark. Give me your opinions.
On you? He gave a theatrical sigh.
Do I have a choice?
You could cut your hair. It makes you look like some kind of vagrant.
Now you sound like my mother.
Well, you do look bloody awful. You could shave, at least. Isn't all that facial hair starting to get itchy? He gave me a sideways look. It is, isn't it? I knew it. Okay, this afternoon I'm going to take it all off.
Oh, no.
Yes. You asked me for my opinion. This is my answer. You don't have to do anything.
What if I say no?
I might do it anyway. If it gets any longer, I'll be picking bits of food out of it. And frankly, if that happens, I'll have to sue you for undue distress in the workplace.
He smiled then, as if I had amused him. It might sound a bit sad, but Will's smiles were so rare that prompting one made me feel a bit light-headed with pride.
"Here, Clark," he said. "Do me a favour."
"What?"
"Scratch my ear for me, will you? It's driving me nuts."
"If I do, you'll let me cut your hair? Just a bit of a trim?"
"Don't push your luck."
"Shh, don't make me nervous. I'm not great with scissors."
I found the razors and some shaving foam in the bathroom cabinet, tucked well back behind the packets of wipes and cotton wool, as if they hadn't been used in some time. I made him come into the bathroom, filled a sink with warm water, got him to tilt his headrest back a little, and then placed a hot flannel over his chin.
"What is this? You're going to be a barber shop? What's the flannel for?"
"I don't know," I confessed. "It's what they do in the films. It's like the hot water and towels when someone has a baby."
I couldn't see his mouth, but his eyes creased with faint mirth. I wanted to keep them like that. I wanted him to be happy, for his face to lose that haunted, watchful look. I gabbled. I told jokes. I started to hum. Anything to prolong the moment before he looked grim again. I rolled up my sleeves and began to lather the shaving foam over his chin, all the way up to his ears. Then I hesitated, the blade over his chin.
"Is this the moment to tell you I've only ever done legs before?"
He closed his eyes and settled back. I began to scrape gently at his skin with the blade, the silence broken only by the splash as I rinsed the razor in the basin full of water. I worked in silence, studying Will Traynor's face as I went, the lines that ran to the corners of his mouth, lines that seemed prematurely deep for his age. I smoothed his hair from the side of his face, and saw the telltale tracks of stitches, perhaps from his accident. I saw the mauve shadows that told of nights and nights of lost sleep, the furrow between his brows that spoke of silent pain. A warm sweetness rose from his skin, the scent of the shaving cream, and something that was peculiar to Will himself, discreet and expensive. His face began to emerge, and I could see how easy it must have been for him to attract someone like Alicia. I worked slowly and carefully, encouraged by the fact that he seemed briefly at peace. The thought flashed by that the only time anyone ever touched Will was for some medical or therapeutic procedure, and so I let my fingers rest lightly upon his skin, trying to make the movements as far from the dehumanized briskness that characterized Nathan's and the doctor's interactions with him as possible. It was a curiously intimate thing, this shaving of Will. I realized as I continued that I had assumed his wheelchair would be a barrier, that his disability would prevent any kind of sensual aspect from creeping in. Weirdly, it wasn't working like that. It was impossible to be this close to someone, to feel their skin tauten under your fingertips, to breathe in the air that they breathed out, to have their face only inches from yours, without feeling a little unbalanced. By the time I reached his other ear, I had begun to feel awkward, as if I had overstepped an invisible mark.
Perhaps Will was able to read the subtle changes in my pressure on his skin. Perhaps he was just more attuned to the moods of the people around him. But he opened his eyes, and I found them looking into mine. There was a short pause, and then he said, straight-faced,
"Please don't tell me you've shaved off my eyebrows."
"Only the one," I said. I rinsed the blade, hoping that the colour would have drained from my cheeks by the time I turned round. "Right," I said finally. "Have you had enough? Won't Nathan be here in a bit?"
"What about my hair?"
he said. "You really want me to cut it?"
"You might as well."
"I thought you didn't trust me."
He shrugged as far as he could. It was the smallest movement of his shoulders.
"If it will stop you moaning at me for a couple of weeks, I figure it's a small price to pay."
"Oh my God, your mum is going to be so delighted," I said, wiping a stray dob of shaving cream.
"Yes, well, we won't let that put us off."
We cut his hair in the living room. I lit the fire, we put on a film, an American thriller, and I placed a towel around his shoulders. I had warned Will that I was a bit rusty, but added that it couldn't look worse than it did already.
"Thanks for that," he said.
I set to work, letting his hair slide through my fingers, trying to remember the few basics I had learnt. Will, watching the film, seemed relaxed and almost content. Occasionally he told me something about the film, what else the lead actor had starred in, where he had first seen it, and I made a vaguely interested noise, like I do with Thomas when he presents me with his toys, even though all my attention was actually focused on not mucking up his hair. Finally, I had the worst of it off, and whipped round in front of him to see how he looked.
"Well?"
Will paused the DVD. I straightened up. "I'm not sure I like seeing this much of your face. It's a bit unnerving."
"Feels cold,"
he observed, moving his head from left to right, as if testing the feel of it. "Hold on," I said. "I'll get two mirrors, then you can see it properly. But don't move, there's still a bit of tidying up to be done, possibly an ear to slice." I was in the bedroom, going through his drawers in search of a small mirror, when I heard the door. Two sets of brisk footsteps. Mrs. Trainer's voice lifted, anxious.
"Georgina, please don't."
The door to the living room was wrenched open. I grabbed the mirror and ran out of the room. I had no intention of being found absent again. Mrs. Trainer was standing in the living room doorway, both hands raised to her mouth, apparently witnessing some unseen confrontation.
"You are the most selfish man I ever met," a young woman was shouting. "I can't believe this, Will. You were selfish then, and you're worse now."
"Georgina!"
Mrs. Trainer's gaze flicked towards me as I approached.
"Please stop!"
I walked into the room behind her. Will, the towel around his shoulders, hair in soft brown fronds at the wheels of his chair, was facing a young woman. She had long dark hair, pinned into a messy knot at the back of her head. Her skin was tanned, and she was wearing expensively distressed jeans and suede boots. Like Alicia, her features were beautiful and regular, her teeth the astonishing white of a toothpaste commercial. I knew they were, because her face puce with anger, she was still hissing at him.
I can't believe it! I can't believe you would even think of it! What do you...
Please, Georgina!
Mrs. Trainor's voice lifted sharply.
This is not the time!
Will, his face impassive, was staring straight ahead of him at some unseen point.
Will, do you need any help?
I said quietly.
Who are you?
She said, whipping round. It was then that I saw her eyes were filled with tears.
Georgina,
Will said.
Meet Louisa Clark, my paid companion and shockingly inventive hairdresser. Louisa, meet my sister, Georgina. She appears to have flown all the way from Australia to shriek at me.
Don't be facile, Georgina said. Mummy told me. She's told me everything.
Nobody moved.
Shall I give you a minute?
I said.
That would be a good idea.
Mrs. Trainor's knuckles were white on the arm of the sofa. I slid out of the room.
In fact, Louisa, perhaps now would be a good time to take your lunch break.
It was going to be a bus shelter kind of a day. I grabbed my sandwiches from the kitchen, climbed into my coat, and set off down the back path. As I left, I could hear Georgina Trainor's voice lifting inside the house.
Has it ever occurred to you, Will, that believe it or not, this might not be just about you?
When I returned, exactly half an hour later, the house was silent. Nathan was washing up a mug in the kitchen sink. He turned as he saw me.
How are you doing?
Has she gone?
Who?
The sister. He glanced behind him.
Ah, that who it was. Yeah, she's gone. Just getting off in her car when I got here. Some sort of family row, was it?
I don't know, I said. I was in the middle of cutting Will's hair, and this woman came in and just started having a go at him. I assumed it was another girlfriend. Nathan shrugged. I realized he would not be interested in the personal minutiae of Will's life, even if he knew.
He's a bit quiet, though. Nice work with the shave, by the way. Good to get him out from behind all that shrubbery.
I walked back into the living room. Will was sitting staring at the television, which was still paused at the exact moment I had left it.
Do you want me to turn this back on? I said.
He didn't seem to hear me for a minute. His head was sunk in his shoulders, the earlier relaxed expression replaced by a veil. Will was closed off again, locked behind something I couldn't penetrate. He blinked, as if he had only just noticed me there.
Sure,
he said. I was carrying a basket of washing down the hall when I heard them. The annex door was slightly ajar, and the voices of Mrs. Trainor and her daughter carried down the long corridor, the sound coming in muted waves. Will's sister was sobbing quietly, all fury gone from her voice now. She sounded almost childlike.
There must be something they can do. Some medical advance. Can't you take him to America? Things are always improving in America.
Your father keeps a very close eye on all the developments. But no, darling, there is nothing concrete.
He's so different now. It's like he's determined not to see the good in anything.
He's been like that since the start, George. I think it's just that you didn't see him apart from when you flew home.
Back then, I think he was still determined. Back then, he was sure that something would change.
I felt a little uncomfortable listening in on such a private conversation, but the odd tenor drew me closer. I found myself walking softly towards the door, my socked feet making no sound on the floor.
"Look, Daddy and I didn't tell you. We didn't want to upset you. But he tried..."
She struggled over the words.
"Will tried to... He tried to kill himself."
"What?"
"Daddy found him. Back in December. It was terrible."
Even though this only really confirmed what I had guessed, I felt all the blood drain from me. I heard a muffled cry, a whispered reassurance. There was another long silence. And then Georgina, her voice thick with grief, spoke again.
"The girl?"
"Yes. Louisa is here to make sure nothing like that happens again."
I stopped. At the other end of the corridor, from the bathroom, I could hear Nathan and Will talking in a low murmur, comfortably oblivious to the conversation that was going on just a few feet away. I took a step closer to the door. I suppose I had known it since I caught sight of the scars on his wrists. It made sense of everything, after all. Mrs. Traynor's anxiety that I shouldn't leave Will alone for very long. His antipathy to having me there. The fact that for large stretches of time I didn't feel like I was doing anything useful at all. I had been babysitting. I hadn't known it, but Will had, and he had hated me for it. I reached for the handle of the door, preparing to close it gently. I wondered what Nathan knew. I wondered whether Will was happier now. I realized I felt, selfishly, a faint relief that it hadn't been me Will objected to. Just the fact that I, that anyone, had been employed to watch over him. My thoughts hummed so busily that I almost missed the next snatch of conversation.
"You can't let him do this, Mum. You have to stop him."
"It's not our choice, darling."
"But it is. It is, if he's asking you to be part of it,"
Georgina protested. The handle stilled in my hand.
"I can't believe you're even agreeing to it. What about your religion? What about everything you've done? What was the point in you even bloody saving him the last time?"
Mrs. Traynor's voice was deliberately calm.
"That's not fair."
"But you've said you'll take him. What does..."
"Do you think for a moment that if I said I refuse, he wouldn't ask someone else?"
"But Dignitas, it's just wrong. I know it's hard for him, but it will destroy you and Daddy. I know it. Think of how you would feel. Think of the publicity, your job, both your reputations. He must know it. It's a selfish thing to even ask. How can he? How can he do this? How can you do this?"
She began to sob again.
"George, don't look at me like that. I do care about him, Mummy. I do. He's my brother and I love him. But I can't bear it. I can't bear even the thought of it. He's wrong to ask, and you're wrong to consider it. And it's not just his own life he will destroy if you go ahead with this."
I took a step back from the window. The blood thumped so loudly in my ears that I almost didn't hear Mrs. Trainor's response.
6 months, George. He promised to give me 6 months. Now, I don't want you to mention this again, and certainly not in front of anyone else. And we must...
She took a deep breath.
We must just pray very hard that something happens in that time to change his mind.
Eight.
Camilla. I never set out to help kill my son. Even reading the words seems odd, like something you might see in a tabloid newspaper, or one of those awful magazines that the cleaner always has poking out of her handbag, full of women whose daughters ran off with their cheating partners, tales of amazing weight loss and two-headed babies. I was not the kind of person this happened to, or at least I thought I wasn't. My life was a fairly structured one, an ordinary one by modern standards. I had been married for almost 37 years. I raised 2 children. I kept my career, helped out at the school, the PTA, and joined the bench, once the children didn't need me anymore. I had been a magistrate for almost 11 years now. I watched the whole of human life come through my court. The hopeless waifs who couldn't get themselves together sufficiently even to make a court appointment on time. The repeat offenders. The angry, hard-faced young men. And exhausted, debt-ridden mothers. It's quite hard to stay calm and understanding when you see the same faces, the same mistakes made again and again. I could sometimes hear the impatience in my tone. It could be oddly dispiriting, the blank refusal of humankind to even attempt to function responsibly. And our little town, despite the beauty of the castle, our many Grade 2 listed buildings, our picturesque country lanes, was far from immune to it. Our Regency Squares held cider-drinking teenagers. Our thatched cottages muffled the sounds of husbands beating their wives and children. Sometimes I felt like King Canute, making vain pronouncements in the face of a tide of chaos and creeping devastation. But I loved my job. I did it because I believe in order, in a moral code. I believe that there is a right and a wrong, unfashionable as that view might be. I got through the tougher days because of my garden. As the children grew, it had become a bit of an obsession of mine. I could give you the Latin name of almost any plant you cared to point at. The funny thing was, I didn't even do Latin at school. Mine was a rather minor public school for girls, where the focus was on cooking and embroidery, things that would help us become good wives. But the thing about those plant names is that they do stick in your head. I only ever needed to hear one once to remember it forever. Helleborus niger, Eremerus stenophilus, Athyrium nipponicum. I can repeat those with a fluency I never had at school. They say you only really appreciate a garden once you reach a certain age, and I suppose there is a truth in that. It's probably something to do with the great circle of life. There seems to be something miraculous about seeing the relentless optimism of new growth after the bleakness of winter. A kind of joy in the difference every year. The way nature chooses to show off different parts of the garden to its full advantage. There have been times, the times when my marriage proved to be somewhat more populated than I had anticipated, when it has been a refuge, times when it has been a joy. There have even been times when it was, frankly, a pain. There is nothing more disappointing than creating a new border only to see it fail to flourish. Or to watch a row of beautiful alliums destroyed overnight by some slimy culprit. But even when I complained about the time, the effort involved in caring for it, The way my joints protested at an afternoon spent weeding, or my fingernails never looked quite clean. I loved it. I loved the sensual pleasures of being outside. The smell of it. The feel of the earth under my fingers. The satisfaction of seeing things living, glowing, captivated by their own temporary beauty. After Will's accident, I didn't garden for a year. It wasn't just the time, although the endless hours spent at hospital, the time to-ing and fro-ing in the car, the meetings, oh God, the meetings, took up so much of it. I took 6 months' compassionate leave from work, and there was still not enough of it. It was that I could suddenly see no point. I paid a gardener to come and keep the garden tidy, and I don't think I gave it anything but the most cursory of looks for the best part of a year. It was only when we brought Will back home, once the annex was adapted and ready, that I could see a point in making it beautiful again. I needed to give my son something to look at. I needed to tell him, silently, that things might change, grow or fail, but that life did go on. That we were all part of some great cycle, some pattern that it was only God's purpose to understand. I couldn't say that to him, of course. Will and I have never been able to say much to each other, but I wanted to show him. A silent promise, if you like, that there was a bigger picture, a brighter future. Stephen was poking at the log fire. He manoeuvred the remaining half-burnt logs expertly with a poker, sending glowing sparks up the chimney, then dropped a new log onto the middle. He stood back, as he always did, watching with quiet satisfaction as the flames took hold, and dusted his hands on his corduroy trousers. He turned as I entered the room. I held out a glass.
"Thank you. Is George coming down?"
"Apparently not."
"What's she doing?"
"Watching television upstairs. She doesn't want company. I did ask."
"She'll come round. She's probably jet-lagged."
"I hope so, Stephen. She's not very happy with us at the moment." We stood in silence, watching the fire. Around us the room was dark and still, the window panes rattling gently as they were buffeted by the wind and rain.
"Filthy night."
"Yes." The dog padded into the room, and with a sigh flopped down in front of the fire, gazing up adoringly at us both from her prone position.
"So, what do you think?" he said, "this haircut business."
"I don't know. I'd like to think it's a good sign."
"This Louisa's a bit of a character, isn't she?"
I saw the way my husband smiled to himself. "Not her, too," I found myself thinking, and then squashed the thought. "Yes. Yes, I suppose she is."
"Do you think she is the right one?"
I took a sip of my drink before answering. 2 fingers of gin, a slice of lemon, and a lot of tonic. "Who knows?" I said. "I don't think I have the faintest idea what is right and wrong any more."
"He likes her. I'm sure he likes her. We were talking while watching the news the other night, and he mentioned her twice. He hasn't done that before."
"Yes. Well, I wouldn't get your hopes up."
"Do you have to?"
Stephen turned from the fire. I could see him studying me, perhaps conscious of the new lines around my eyes, the way my mouth seemed set these days into a thin line of anxiety. He looked at the little gold cross, now ever present around my neck. I didn't like it when he looked at me like that. I could never escape the feeling that I was being compared to someone else. "I'm just being realistic."
You sound like you're already expecting it to happen."
"I know my son."
"Our son?"
"Yes, our son. More my son," I found myself thinking. "You were never really there for him, not emotionally. You were just the absence he was always striving to impress.
He'll change his mind, Stephen said. There's still a long way to go.
We stood there. I took a long sip of my drink, the ice cold against the warmth given out by the fire. I keep thinking, I said, staring into the hearth. I still keep thinking that I'm missing something. My husband was still watching me. I could feel his gaze on me, but I couldn't meet it. Perhaps he might have reached out to me then. But I think we'd probably gone too far for that. He took a sip of his drink.
You can only do what you can do, darling.
I'm well aware of that, but it's not really enough, is it? He turned back to the fire, poking unnecessarily at a log, until I turned and quietly left the room, as he had known I would. When Will first told me what he wanted, he had to tell me twice, as I was quite sure I could not have heard him correctly the first time. I stayed quite calm when I realized what he was proposing, and then I told him he was being ridiculous, and I walked straight out of the room. It's an unfair advantage being able to walk away from a man in a wheelchair. There are two steps between the annex and the main house, and without Nathan's help, he could not traverse them. I shut the door of the annex, and I stood in my own hallway, with the calmly spoken words of my son still ringing in my ears. I'm not sure I moved for half an hour. He refused to let it go. Being Will, he always had to have the last word. He repeated his request every time I went in to see him, until I almost had to persuade myself to go in each day.
I don't want to live like this, Mother. This is not the life I chose.
There is no prospect of my recovery. Hence it is a perfectly reasonable request to ask to end it in a manner I see fit. I heard him, and could well imagine what he had been like in those business meetings, the career that had made him rich and arrogant. He was a man who was used to being heard, after all. He couldn't bear it that in some way I had the power to dictate his future, that I had somehow become Mother again. It took his attempt to make me agree. It's not that my religion forbade it, although the prospect of Will being consigned to hell through his own desperation was a terrible one. I chose to believe that God, a benign God, would understand our sufferings and forgive us our trespasses. It's just that the thing you never understand about being a mother until you are one is that it is not the grown man, the galumphing, unshaven, stinking, opinionated offspring you see before you, with his parking tickets and unpolished shoes and complicated love life. You see all the people he has ever been, all rolled up into one. I looked at Will, and I saw the baby I held in my arms, dewily besotted, unable to believe that I had created another human being. I saw the toddler reaching for my hand, the schoolboy weeping tears of fury after being bullied by some other child. I saw the vulnerabilities, the love, the history. That's what he was asking me to extinguish. The small child as well as the man. All that love. All that history. And then, on the 22nd of January, a day when I was stuck in court with a relentless roll call of shoplifters and uninsured drivers, of weeping, angry ex-partners, Stephen walked into the annex and found our son almost unconscious, his head lolling by his armrest, a sea of dark, sticky blood pooling around his wheels. He had located a rusty nail, barely half an inch emerging from some hurriedly finished woodwork in the back lobby, and, pressing his wrist against it, had reversed backwards and forwards until his flesh was sliced to ribbons. I cannot to this day imagine the determination that kept him going, even though he must have been half delirious from the pain. The doctor said he was less than 20 minutes from death. It was not, they observed with exquisite understatement, a cry for help. When they told me at the hospital that Will would live, I walked outside into my garden and I raged. I raged at God, at nature, at whatever fate had brought our family to such depths. Now I look back, and I must have seemed quite mad. I stood in my garden that cold evening, and I hurled my large brandy 20 feet into the Euonymus compactus, and I screamed, so that my voice broke the air, bouncing off the castle walls and echoing into the distance. I was so furious, you see, that all around me were things that could move and bend and grow and reproduce, and my son, my vital, charismatic, beautiful boy, was just this thing. Immobile, wilted, bloodied, suffering. Their beauty seemed like an obscenity. I screamed and I screamed and I swore, words I didn't know I knew, until Stephen came out and stood, his hand resting on my shoulder, waiting until he could be sure that I would be silent again. He didn't understand, you see. He hadn't worked it out yet, that Will would try again. That our lives would have to be spent in a state of constant vigilance, waiting for the next time, waiting to see what horror he would inflict upon himself. We would have to see the world through his eyes, the potential poisons, the sharp objects, the inventiveness with which he could finish the job that damned motorcyclist had started. Our lives had to shrink, to fit around the potential for that one act. And he had the advantage. He had nothing else to think about, you see. 2 weeks later, I told Will. Yes. Of course I did. What else could I have done?
Chapter 9. I didn't sleep that night. I lay awake in the little box room, gazing up at the ceiling and carefully reconstructing the last 2 months based on what I now knew. It was as if everything had shifted, fragmented and settled in some other place, into a pattern I barely recognised. I felt duped, the dim-witted accessory who hadn't known what was going on. I felt they must have laughed privately at my attempts to feed Will vegetables or cut his hair, little things to make him feel better. What had been the point, after all? I ran over and over the conversation I had heard, trying to interpret it in some alternative way, trying to convince myself that I had misunderstood what they had said. But Dignitas wasn't exactly somewhere you went for a mini-break. I couldn't believe Camilla Trainer could contemplate doing that to her son. Yes, I had thought her cold, and yes, awkward around him. It was hard to imagine her cuddling him, as my mother had cuddled us, fiercely, joyously, until we wriggled away, begging to be let go. If I'm honest, I just thought it was how the upper classes were with their children. I had just read Will's copy of Love in a Cold Climate, after all. But to actively, to voluntarily play a part in her own son's death? With hindsight, her behaviour seemed even colder, her actions imbued with some sinister intent. I was angry with her, and angry with Will, angry with them for letting me engage in a facade. I was angry for all the times I had sat and thought about how to make things better for him, how to make him comfortable or happy. When I was not angry, I was sad. I would recall the slight break in her voice as she tried to comfort Georgina and feel a great sadness for her. She was, I knew, in an impossible position. But mostly I felt filled with horror. I was haunted by what I now knew. How could you live each day knowing that you were simply whiling away the days until your own death? How could this man whose skin I had felt that morning under my fingers, warm and alive, choose to just extinguish himself? How could it be that with everyone's consent, in 6 months' time that same skin would be decaying under the ground. I couldn't tell anyone. That was almost the worst bit. I was now complicit in the trainer's secret. Sick and listless, I rang Patrick to say I wasn't feeling well and was going to stay home. No problem, he was doing a 10K, he said. He probably wouldn't be through at the athletics club until after 9 anyway. I'd see him on Saturday. He sounded distracted, as if his mind were already elsewhere, further along some mythical track. I refused supper. I lay in bed until my thoughts darkened and solidified to the point where I couldn't bear the weight of them. And at 8:30, I came back downstairs and sat silently watching television, perched on the other side of Grandad, who was the only person in our family guaranteed not to ask me a question. He sat in his favourite armchair and stared at the screen with glassy-eyed intensity. I was never sure whether he was watching or whether his mind was somewhere else entirely. "Are you sure I can't get you something, love?" Mum appeared at my side with a cup of tea. There was nothing in our family that couldn't be improved by a cup of tea, allegedly. "No, not hungry, thanks." I saw the way she glanced at Dad. I knew that later on there would be private mutterings that the trainers were working me too hard, that the strain of looking after such an invalid was proving too much. I knew they would blame themselves for encouraging me to take the job. I would have to let them think they were right. Paradoxically, the following day, Will was on good form, unusually talkative, opinionated, belligerent. He talked possibly more than he had talked on any previous day. It was as if he wanted to spar with me and was disappointed when I wouldn't play. "So when are you going to finish this hatchet job, then?" I had been tidying the living room. I looked up from plumping the sofa cushions. "What?" "My hair. I'm only half done. I look like one of those Victorian orphans, or some Hoxton Egypt." He turned his head so that I could better see my handiwork. "Unless this is one of your alternative style statements." "You want me to keep cutting?" "Well, it seemed to keep you happy, and it would be nice not to look like I belong in an asylum." I fetched a towel and scissors in silence. "Nathan is definitely happier now I apparently look like a bloke," he said. "Although he did point out that having restored my face to its former state, I will now need shaving every day." "Oh," I said. "You don't mind, do you? Weekends I'll just have to put up with designer stubble." I couldn't talk to him. I found it difficult even to meet his eye. It was like finding out your boyfriend had been unfaithful. I felt weirdly as if he had betrayed me.
"Clark?"
"Hmm?"
"You're having another unnervingly quiet day. What happened to chatty to the point of vaguely irritating?"
"Sorry," I said.
"Running man again? What's he done now? He hasn't gone and run off, has he?"
"No." I took a soft slice of Will's hair between my index and middle fingers and lifted the blades of the scissors to trim what lay exposed above them. They stilled in my hand. How would they do it? Would they give him an injection? Was it medicine? Or did they just leave you in a room with a load of razors?
"You look tired. I wasn't going to say anything when you came in, but, hell, you look terrible."
"Oh." How did they assist someone who couldn't move their own limbs? I found myself gazing down at his wrists, which were always covered by long sleeves. I had assumed for weeks that this was because he felt the cold more than we did. Another lie.
Clark?
Yes? I was glad I was behind him. I didn't want him to see my face. He hesitated. Where the back of his neck had been covered by hair, it was even paler than the rest of his skin. It looked soft and white and oddly vulnerable.
Look, I'm sorry about my sister. She was very upset. But it didn't give her the right to be rude. She's a bit direct sometimes. Doesn't know how much she rubs people up the wrong way.
He paused.
It's why she likes living in Australia, I think.
You mean they tell each other the truth?
What?
Nothing. Lift your head up, please. I snipped and combed, working my way methodically around his head until every single hair was chopped or trimmed, and all that remained was a fine sprinkling around his feet. It all became clear to me by the end of the day. While Will was watching television with his father, I took a sheet of A4 paper from the printer and a pen from the jar by the kitchen window and wrote down what I wanted to say. I folded the paper, found an envelope, and left it on the kitchen table, addressed to his mother. When I left for the evening, Will and his father were talking. Actually, Will was laughing. I paused in the hallway, my bag over my shoulder, listening. Why would he laugh? What could possibly provoke mirth, given that he had just a matter of weeks before he took his own life?
I'm off,
I called through the doorway and started walking.
Hey, Clark,
he began, but I had already closed the door behind me. I spent the short bus ride trying to work out what I was going to tell my parents. They would be furious that I had left what they would see as a perfectly suitable and well-paid job. After her initial shock, my mother would look pained and defend me, suggesting that it had all been too much. My father would probably ask why I couldn't be more like my sister. He often did, even though I was not the one who ruined her life by getting pregnant and having to rely on the rest of the family for financial support and babysitting. You weren't allowed to say anything like that in our house, because according to my mother it was like implying that Thomas wasn't a blessing, and all babies were God's blessing, even those who said bugger quite a lot, and whose presence meant that half the potential wage earners in our family couldn't actually go and get a decent job. I would not be able to tell them the truth. I knew I owed Will and his family nothing, but I wouldn't inflict the curious gaze of the neighbourhood on him. All these thoughts tumbled around my head as I got off the bus and walked down the hill. And then I got to the corner of our road and heard the shouting, felt the slight vibration in the air, and it was all briefly forgotten. A small crowd had gathered around our house. I picked up my pace, afraid that something had happened. But then I saw my parents on the porch, peering up, and realised it wasn't our house at all. It was just the latest in a long series of small wars that characterised our neighbour's marriage. That Richard Grisham was not the most faithful of husbands was hardly news in our street. But judging by the scene in his front garden, it might have been to his wife.
"You must have thought I was bloody stupid! She was wearing your T-shirt, the one I had made you for your birthday!"
"Baby, Dimpner, it's not what you think.
I went in for your bloody Scotch eggs, and there she was, wearing it, bold as brass, and I don't even like Scotch eggs!"
I slowed my pace, pushing my way through the small crowd until I was able to get to our gate, watching as Richard ducked to avoid a DVD player. Next came a pair of shoes.
"How long have they been at it?"
My mother, her apron tucked neatly around her waist, unfolded her arms and glanced down at her watch. "It's a good 3/4 of an hour,"